Good morning from Asia, Southeast Asia. I am Art Bell. If you're just tuning in, and I know that a lot of you will be because you were probably glued to CNN or Fox or one of the news channels, as well you should have been, apparently North Korea has detonated a nuclear weapon. Here's what we know at this hour. The weapon apparently detonated in an area called Hawardi or something like that in North Korea, the same area where they did some testing, mostly unsuccessful testing, I might add, of some missiles. I'm sure all of you are aware of that news story. The nuclear weapon was, if it was, detonated at 0136 Greenwich Mean Time just a few hours ago. Now, here's what we know. The initial magnitude measured in South Korea of the geologic event was 3.5. The USGS in Florida measured an initial magnitude of 4.2. Based on the 3.5, the United States intelligence agencies said that perhaps the North Koreans did not get what they wanted, which was in excess of 400 kilotons of yield. Now, that may or may not be true with the other estimate of magnitude 4.2. So all that's up in the air right now. In fact, U.S. intelligence right now says they cannot yet completely confirm that there was a nuclear test. But I think most people, most pundits, most newscasters now believe that there indeed was a test. Japan has said it represents a grave threat. The South Korean stock market is falling like a rock at the moment. The prospects are many. The possibilities are many. It could touch off an arms race. The Japanese, who now have a great deal of stored nuclear material, could, and of course have the technology, to construct bombs within weeks or short months. So, there it is. The North Koreans apparently detonating a nuclear weapon. Today is the day the world changed. The North Koreans are a crazy bunch of people. You know, even that's not fair to say. The North Korean leadership is crazy for sure. The North Korean people, for the most part, are just starving to death. Now, in the first hour, we had Kenneth Sewell. And again, thank you, Ian, for making him available to us on very short notice. He suggested the first thing a U.S. president should do under these circumstances would be a complete blockade of North Korea. Kenneth Sewell suggested they've got a submarine fleet that would be perfectly capable of carrying even a crude nuclear device to the U.S. West Coast unless they were stopped. Coming up shortly, Doug Beeson. Talk about lucky scheduling. Doug Beeson is the Associate Laboratory Director of the Los Alamos National Laboratory. Let me say that again. Doug Beeson is the Associate Laboratory Director of Los Alamos National Laboratory, responsible for programs tasked with eliminating the global threat of weapons of mass destruction. A portfolio exceeding $670 million with line responsibility for over 1,600 researchers. He has over 29 years of experience that spans conducting basic research to directing national security programs and formulating national policy. He is the author of 14 novels and 50 scientific publications. He previously served on the White House staff working for the president's science advisor under both the Bush and Clinton administrations, where he was an adjunct member of the National Space Council and was the key White House staffer for space science and technology at NASA. He has performed research at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, directed a plasma physics laboratory, and taught at the U.S. Air Force Academy as an associate professor of physics and director of faculty research. Now, my guess would be that Fox News and CNN would love to have him instead of me having him right now. And I did a little a pre-question to him before we got started here at the top of the hour and had my board ops back there ask him if he was prepared to comment on all of this. And his comment to me was he has not been cleared to talk very much about it. So we really have the right person, but perhaps at the wrong moment. We'll see what we can find out with our guest, Dr. Doug Beeson, in a moment.
Thank you.
Once again, we are very fortunate in a way to have Dr. Beeson on right now, Associate Laboratory Director of Los Alamos National Laboratory. Doctor, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that.
I appreciate the fact that this happened just literally moments before the program, and that puts you, I guess, in a very awkward position.
Well, in a way it does. I'm not in a policy position right now. It's really a technical support, being at Los Alamos National Laboratory. We're one of several laboratories in the National Lab system that work for the National Nuclear Security Agency, and part of our mission is to support the government in helping analyze these type of situations. But right now, because it is ongoing and breaking, we're working on the problem, but really haven't been cleared to release any information.
In other words, you know more than you can say.
Well, I did get a phone call about an hour ago from one of my colleagues back at Los Alamos, and I'm in Washington, D.C. right now. And this lady heads up a unit for me that does this type of analysis. And what she was able to tell me over a line was that we were able to confirm at least the location through some of the news sources. And that's, again, about all that I can say.
Okay.
Sorry. But on the other hand, you never want to upstage your bosses. And also, things like this are very fluid. And with the changing world situation and with the analysis, the analogy I might use is suppose there's a forest fire somewhere. You might not exactly know where that forest fire is, or you might not even know how big it is or what started it. But there are a lot of what we call signatures that accompany that. You know, there's smoke, there's reports from people, but you might not actually have visual confirmation on that. So you kind of put all these pieces together, and then you make a decision based upon the available data that you have.
Mm-hmm. Let's see what I can ask you. Just tell me that you cannot answer a question if I pose one that you can't answer, and that's probably what I'm going to be doing here. The initial reports of the magnitude of the geologic event in North Korea were from South Korea at 3.5, magnitude 3.5. Now, CNN, or Fox rather, reported that and then said that U.S. intelligence said, well, that might mean that 400 kilotons or better, which is what the North Koreans wanted, was not, in fact, what they achieved. Now, there was then a secondary report from Florida, USGS in Florida, that it was a magnitude 4.2. Do we have a way, this is just a generic question, do we have a way, Doctor, of correlating the magnitude of the geologic event with the yield of the weapon?
Well, there are several ways to do that. You have to understand what type of soil that the experiment took place in, if it was mm-hmm. indeed an experiment, mm-hmm. and that would tell you how much the blast or the shock or the device couples, that is, works with the environment, and from that you can back out a estimate of the yield of the weapon, that is how powerful it is. But again, there's no really right answer on this because the data that you get from these different seismic stations are all going to be a little bit different, and so the experts really have to make the best guess based upon their judgment as to what the yield is. And when I say that there's no exact right answer, each of these data points that you get have what we call error bars. That is, there are errors that are associated with obtaining the data. And when this occurs, then again, you have to use your best judgment as an expert in the field as to what caused those errors, and from that you can back out what the yield might be.
Mm-hmm. Well, whether it was what they expected or not, I it seems it's increasingly clear that they did detonate something or another. And, of course, if North Korea has a nuclear device now, they probably have more than one. I think most intelligence that's even public agrees on that, possibly a half dozen or more of them. I went into the beginning of last hour, Doctor, sort of confident that, well, the west coast of the United States is safe because obviously they don't have a method of delivery to get particularly what probably is a big, physically big bomb, you know, across that kind of distance. And then my guest reminded me that North Korea has a fleet of submarines. And I asked my last guest what he would do if he was president. He said he would he'd have a blockade of North Korea up very, very quickly, a complete blockade, and simply not let anything out. Does that sound like a reasonable response to you?
Well, that's certainly one option, but I think galvanizing the entire international community would really be the first thing that the president would probably do. And you made a very good point on this, and a lot of people, I think, are missed that point, is that just because somebody has a nuclear capability doesn't mean that they have a what we call a revolution in military affairs. That is a way to actually use that capability. China, for example, in the 60s detonated an atomic bomb, but it wasn't until recently where there was the means to deliver that atomic bomb where they actually caused a revolution in their own military affairs. And so it's just not the device itself, but it's also the delivery mechanism. A nuclear weapon is typically something that's very big. It wasn't until the United States itself had worked for many years trying to refine our own designs that we were able to put them on delivery vehicles that were able to be transported very far distances. Because remember, these are really paradoxical weapons in the sense is that they're not only the most destructive weapons known to man, but also the most dangerous, but they also have to be made the most safe because you never want to have an incident or a safety incident where they might go off accidentally. And so as a result, to keep this huge amount of power leashed up in a way, you have to put in safety mechanisms to prevent that, which makes it very large. And unless you have a very sophisticated engineering program to go along with the development of this, then it's pretty tough to get this in a very small package that you can smuggle it unknown through typical type of delivery vehicles.
Typical. Again, my guest last hour suggested to me they have quite a submarine fleet in North Korea, not the modern nuclear submarines that we have, right, of course, but apparently submarines that are quite capable of making it to the U.S. West Coast. Now, to put all this in perspective, let's suppose that the yield was in the area of 400 kilotons. If a 400-kiloton device went off close to a U.S. city, for example, in the harbor at San Francisco or something like that, how much destructive power would a device, again, we're talking in general terms now, would a device of that size have?
Well, it would really depend, believe it or not, where that device was located. And I'm not trying to be flippant, but if it was, say, close to the ground, you wouldn't have as much as destructive power as you would if it was, say, elevated some distance above the ground. And the reason for that is that the closer to the ground that you get with a device like this, the more coupling, that is, interaction with the ground that you're going to have, and the less, say, blast effects. There's a whole library of data that had been built up over the past several decades from underground and above ground tests that show what the optimum height burst might be, what a ground burst would be versus an air burst, and it really depends upon the effect that you want to have. Of course, any burst at all would be devastating near a American city, but it would really depend upon the location of where that burst would be.
The blasts in Nagasaki and Hiroshima were about what size, kiloton-wise?
Around 18 kilotons, up around on the order of 20 kilotons.
20 kilotons. And again, the estimations are perhaps 400 kilotons for this or less for this a device just set off in North Korea.
I can't really comment on the yield, but 400 kilotons it would be incredibly, incredibly high. In fact, I think what I might have seen on CNN was actually 400 tons and not 400 kilotons, which is...
Really?
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, from what I've seen on the news services, they were quoting senior intelligence officials as saying it's more than a fizz than a pop, which would lead me to believe, again, from unclassified sources, that they might not have gotten quite the yield that they were expecting.
That they wanted, yeah, I heard
right.
that. But again, that might make that we might have to wait on what they finally settle out on in terms of the magnitude of the geologic disruption that resulted. Is that fair?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, I just want to make it clear that you know, tonight I'm actually being interviewed for my book on directed energy, and I'm not representing myself in an official capacity from Los Alamos. I'm answering these questions as a private citizen.
Yes,
you never want to upstage your boss. It's called getting out in front of the headlights. You never want to do that.
I really do understand, believe me. And I'll try and be as gentle as I can.
Right. And there's another purpose for that, R2, is that you never want to quite tip your hand either on what information you do know, because that gives adversaries or other people a knowledge of what your capabilities are as well.
Well, that's right. I mean, if we have satellites that can detect a nuclear explosion, for example, independent of any other source, we wouldn't want them to know that.
Other type of way to get the data.
Or any other way, yes, indeed, including human intelligence or whatever else you might have. Of course, you don't want to tip your hand, and I don't want you to tip any hands at all at the moment. And I know it's very awkward for you, but it's almost impossible for me not to discuss this. Can you venture into the world of just your opinion without getting in trouble?
Sure, but I'll make it clear there's my opinion.
Okay. Okay. Let's do it that way then. The politics of this. If you were our president right now, and you were mulling over, obviously there's going to be a lot of UN Security Council action very quickly on this, or at least we can hope there will be. But the United States would have to also, I think, be considering the possibility of some sort of unilateral action just for our own protection. If you were the president, would you be mulling unilateral action, or would you be saying, no, let's do this Security Council thing first?
Well, again, in my opinion, I don't think that you ever want to take anything off the table, and that you want to be able to consider a spectrum of options. Because remember, the president is charged, his primary duty is the defense of the United States.
You
and
bet.
That you never want to take any option off the table, but then you might want to prioritize which ones you might want to go for first. And the first one, as I said before, is to galvanize international community. Again, the reason you'd never take an option off the table is that you never want to limit yourself, because there's always, when it gets down to it, there's always things that you must do in your own national security interest.
Doctor, you know, there's been a lot of talk about just how crazy Kim is, how crazy this government of North Korea is. How crazy do you think they are?
Oh, boy. Again, I feel very... but just because of the association that, you know, if you were to come up to me and ask me on the street, I guess I could say one opinion. But just because of the association with Los Alamos, I think that... this is somebody that our government deals very carefully with, very seriously with. And again, it's something that they are pushing to work with the international community on. And again, I'm sorry for.
No, it's all right, Doctor. All right. My guest is Dr. Doug Beeson, who is, for obvious reasons, being very, very careful. He is the Associate Laboratory Director of Los Alamos National Laboratory. And in a way, it's a very unfortunate time for him to be here in view of the breaking news that we all have right now. And again, apparently, North Korea has detonated a nuclear device. And without question, that changes So that changes the world in one day, just like that. I'm Art Bell. Boy, talk about having luck and the right guy, but at just the wrong time. Dr. Doug Beeson is the Associate Laboratory Director for the Los Alamos National Laboratory, responsible for programs tasked with eliminating the global threat of weapons of mass destruction. Now, if that isn't the right guy, I don't know who is. On 2 or 3 hours old news that North Korea has probably detonated a nuclear weapon. We'll see what else we can find out from Dr. Beeson. It may not be a lot because he's not been clear to say a whole lot about this so far. And we'll do all that in a moment. A dream and a nightmare. Here I've got exactly the right guy at the wrong time. Dr. Beeson, you've written a book called The E-Bomb, How America's New Directed Energy Weapons Will Change the Way Wars Will Be Fought in the Future. How long has your book been out?
It came out about this time last year in hardback, and they just reissued it, in fact, this month, the beginning of the month, in mass market paperback. And so, just out within the past few days.
Which means that it's a reasonable buy, very reasonable now on Amazon.com and places like that, right?
Absolutely. In fact, it's really, talk about being at the right place at the wrong time. The North Korea threat is one of the first ones that I use in the opening chapters of my book.
Let's approach it this way. Let's talk about the chapter that you wrote on North Korea.
Right. Well, one of the real worries is that having a rogue nation like North Korea that had a limited capability to loft intercontinental ballistic missiles, what do you do to stop that threat? Well, that was one of the problems that General Ron Fogelman, who is the four-star Chief of Staff of the Air Force, had actually encountered back during the first Iraq War. And it was then that the U.S. military had realized is that trying to go after the Scud missile threat, those were tactical ballistic missiles, was nearly impossible because the Iraq was so large, trying to find these missiles before they were launched was nearly impossible because Iraq was such a large country. And trying to target them and then get them to down them was, again, nearly an impossible task. And that's when the concept of having a huge weaponizable laser, that is a laser that was big enough to actually bring down ballistic missiles and put that on an aircraft, was considered to be one way to be able to kill ballistic missiles as they were being launched. And this concept that is known as the airborne laser actually grew from the 90s. A special program office was established at Kirtland Air Force Base outside of Albuquerque, New Mexico. And today we have a jet aircraft the size of a 747 that is being outfitted with a laser that is in what they call the megawatt class power level to be able to fly outside of a adversary's borders, and when a missile is launched, the U.S. will soon have the capability to bring that missile down with using not anti-missile missiles, but by using a huge, powerful laser that's on board this aircraft.
Mm-hmm. Backing up just a little bit, Doctor, there was a lot of controversy about how many Scuds, which actually were launched, that we brought down with anti-missiles. Do you know what the actual record is or was?
Well, from what I understand, there was actually no 100% intercepts of the warhead itself. That is, if you look at the Patriot missiles that were used during the first Iraq conflict, none of the warheads were directly hit. On the other hand, some of the missile bodies were hit. But from what I understand is that This is the post-war analysis that was conducted, that there were no actual warheads that were directly hit by any of these Patriot missiles.
Wow. But we actually did bring some down by hitting the missile bodies?
Or else we were very close. We were able to detonate very close to them. Of course, that was using that 1980s technology with that. But the problem, though, with trying to intercept a missile with a another missile is that these missiles, anti-missiles, all travel at ballistic missile speed. That is many thousands of feet per second. And during that time, these missiles can take what they call evasive maneuvers. That is, that they can try to detect the oncoming anti-missile, and they can try to move if you have that type of sophisticated apparatus. Now, some, of course, nowadays, the adversary countries such as North Korea, it's debatable whether or not they have that capability. But if you were to go against any type of adversary using a traditional, conventional warhead, then you always have to take the time of flight into consideration. That is, you have to calculate where the missile is going to be, and you have to not shoot directly at the missile that you're trying to bring down, but you have to calculate the trajectory and then try to shoot that missile down where you think it's going to be. And that's one of the beauties of having a directed energy weapon such as a laser. That is, because lasers are made up of parts of the electromagnetic spectrum, just like light. Light travels at the speed of light. Laser energy travels at the speed of light. Mm-hmm. And so, therefore, all you have to do is aim it, and you have, and you instantly deposit the energy where you want to aim it.
Right. So hitting a missile in flight is not so tough for a laser compared to an anti-missile.
That's right. Now, it's still a pretty tough problem. And in fact, our whole missile defense strategy is based upon not just relying on one type of technology to bring down these missiles. And that's why I think that it will be a very successful program, because you're not looking for what is known as just the silver bullet. That is just one type of technology. That is, at the very beginning of the conflict, when the adversary is just launching these missiles, you go after the missiles, those missiles, in what they call the boost phase. That is, when the missiles are still accelerating into the air, you can detect them very easily, and they're very fragile.
Yeah, and they're moving quite slowly compared to what they're going to be doing.
Exactly, and the United States has chosen to use the airborne laser, for example, as one of the ways to kill off a certain percentage of those missiles while it's still in that so-called boost phase.
Okay, again, Doctor, I don't want to ask you anything classified, but one obvious question is, what would the range of such a device be?
Well, the typical scenario of the airborne laser is to stand off a few, at least 100 kilometers, if not further, from the adversary's borders. And when the missile launch is detected, you watch that missile as it rises above the ground, and there are various sensors that you can engage to do that. And it's just not one sensor, but there are radar sensors, there are optical sensors, and some of those sensors are actually on board the airborne laser itself. And then when the missile accelerates above what they call the cloud layer, that is typically above 30 to 40,000 feet, then the airborne laser engages its laser onto that missile. That is, it locks onto it. There are several smaller, lower-power lasers that actually track the still-accelerating missile. They not only track it, but also they compensate for the atmosphere. That is, the atmosphere itself is changing. It's fluctuating. There's differences in the atmosphere because of the atmospheric differences. There's dust in the air. There's water in the air. And all these things causes the laser beam to break up as it's going towards the missile. And there are methods that is called atmospheric compensation methods that actually focus the laser beam through these distorted atmosphere patches so that when it reaches the actual missile itself, it's at its focal length, that is, it's at its most powerful. And so this whole process takes on the order of seconds, anywhere from 10 seconds to a minute, for the laser to lock onto the target, for it to compensate through the atmosphere, and then for the high-powered beam to propagate. And that happens over at least 100 kilometers.
And Dr. Beeson, how much difference in effectiveness is there using a weapon of that sort from ground level to, let's say, 35 or 40,000 feet?
Actually, it's more effective the higher the laser is.
I understand.
Up in the air.
Yes.
And the reason for that is that you have less atmosphere to go through. The atmosphere is less dense when you're higher. And so that's the whole idea of putting this weapon class laser on a 747 size aircraft and trying to get up as high as you can so that you don't have to punch through the atmosphere.
Okay, so...
In fact, the range that you can shoot this laser out is even greater, because when you're on the ground, you only have a very limited field of view, but when you're up in the air, you have a much greater field of view. That is, you can actually see further, and also the atmosphere is a lot less dense, so you can actually propagate that laser further.
Right. That's kind of what I was asking. How much difference in effectiveness between ground level and, say, 40,000 feet? It's a tremendous difference, I guess, right?
Tremendous. In fact, I could give... there are things called optical depths that I could throw out. That's the distance where a certain percentage of the laser energy is absorbed by the atmosphere. That optical depth decreases radically the higher up that you go. That's why the airborne laser wants to operate above 35 to 40,000 feet.
Well, then, Doctor, didn't Ronald Reagan have it right? In other words, if what you're telling me is true, about the higher you go, the more effective it is. And you pointed out the better view you have. Well, then, hell, if you've got a satellite up there, not only do you have a better view, but you have almost no resistance at all from some level of orbit above the Earth, yes?
Well, that's true, but on the other hand, a lot of other problems pop up with that. And I talk about that in my book, The E-Bomb, is that you can actually put a laser on an airplane and get a lot of the weapon effects that you can, just about the same effects that you can by putting that laser in space. The problem is that if you put the laser in space, sure, you have a much greater field of view, but your problems escalate exponentially. For example, now you have to put it on a satellite. Mm-hmm. And when you put a laser on a satellite, you have a lot more problems in storing the material, in re-energizing the material, keeping the beam stable, and it's just incredibly more difficult to put the laser in space than it is by flying it in the air. Now, one solution to that, to extend the length of the laser even farther, is not to put the laser itself in space, but to put a mirror in space and reflect the laser beam off of that mirror and direct that to nearly any point on the Earth. And in fact, a experiment was conducted back in the 1990s called the Relay Mirror Experiment, RME, the Relay Mirror Experiment, where a satellite was actually flown with a mirror on it, and a laser beam was directed from the Earth onto another target that was many kilometers away. That is, the laser went from the ground up to space and was redirected onto a target, and so it was proven that that technology can work.
Is there any current agreement that we have internationally that would prevent us from doing that?
Not from actually moving the laser through space. There might be some international agreements that would have to be worked out by putting the laser in space, and that is by... there are agreements about not weaponizing space itself.
Right. No. I was referring to just the mirror assembly aspect of it.
It's kind of like a bomb being lofted intercontinentally. Is that the bomb traverses through space, be it an atomic bomb or whatever, but it's not originating from space. So there's a difference from keeping that bomb in space and then dropping it versus just traversing mm-hmm. through space.
Mm-hmm.
So the same type of concept.
Okay, so we could then conceivably not get in international political trouble by having a mirror there that would reflect what we fire from the ground.
Right. In fact, you'd want more than one, just one mirror on that. You'd want several so that you could be able to reach any point on Earth. In fact, there's right now there is a experiment that is being conducted to put a mirror not on a satellite, which had already been proven at that concept had already been proven at lower powers, but to put a mirror on a airship that is a high altitude balloon that goes up many thousands of feet, and to be able to show that you can use a laser weapon in a tactical scenario, that is on a tactical battlefield rather than a strategic battlefield, and that is. It's a Missile Defense Agency, an MDA program, where a mirror is going to be lofted by a dirigible, kind of like a one of those old hydrogen crafts that you're probably familiar with, and to keep that in the air over a battlefield so that you can actually divert lasers from the ground or from the air onto this mirror and divert it to other parts of the battlefield.
Oh, that's incredible. Since you're in the field of directed energy weapons, I've been following the HAARP project now for a long time. HAARP up in Alaska, I'm sure you're quite familiar with it.
Right.
Can you tell me, Doctor, whether there are? I know the wall I'm going to run into here. Are there any military applications for HAARP that you're aware of that we're not?
Well, I guess if I were to say yes, I'm aware of it, but I can't tell you about it or whatever. Well, one interesting thing I've heard about HAARP to kind of divert the
go ahead, divert my question.
The question is that if a low altitude nuclear burst were to occur, that could upset the plasma in the Van Allen belt, which is a charged particle belt that encircles the Earth,
mm-hmm.
And if that plasma is upset by a low altitude nuclear burst, then it could actually hurt communication satellites because it affects what we call the plasma transmission frequency. That is, you know how when spacecraft are coming into the Earth, when the shuttle comes into the Earth, we lose contact, radio contact with
that's
it.
That's right. Yes,
and that's because of the plasma that's built up around the spacecraft. Plasma is the fourth state of matter. It's, the first three states are solid, liquid, and gas. Well, there's a fourth state of matter out there that actually about 99% of the universe is in this state of matter. And that's what the stars are in the state of matter. That's where the electrons are ripped away from the atomic nucleus. And it's kind of like a hot, soupy, gaseous mixture that exists. 99% of the universe is in the state of matter. But there is a phenomenon known as the plasma cutoff frequency, that radio waves below a certain frequency cannot propagate through it. Again, that's why radio contacts cut off with the shuttle. Well, if a low-altitude nuclear burst were to occur, then the plasma would be energized in these radiation belts, and communication might be cut off. In fact, this phenomenon was actually occurred during the 1950s when the Starfish nuclear explosion was detonated above the South Pacific.
How far above the South Pacific was that detonated?
I'm not sure the exact height, but it was several hundred kilometers. And if something like that were to occur, then communication could be cut off for a certain period of time. Anyway, the whole point of this story is that some people have said, gee, it might be possible to use HAARP to actually change some of the environmental parameters in that in those electron belts. That is, if we were to energize them in a certain way, we might cause some of those electrons to fly out of that belt.
And so you believe that could be true?
It could be. It would take a lot of power to do that, and it would be kind of tough, but that will...
All right, doctor, hold it right there. We're at the top of the hour. Dr. Doug Beeson is my guest. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM.